You're listening to Every Voice Matters with Dori Francis, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hi, everyone. Good morning, good afternoon. This is Dori Francis with Every Voice Matters. So glad to have you here today and have just another interesting guest for everyone to learn from and hear more about another topic regarding polygraphs. Jared Rockwood actually is somebody that I've known for a number of years. I met him when he was the clinical director at a residential treatment center, and he worked with some of my clients. So prior to entering the field of polygraph, which is what Jared specializes in now, he spent a majority of his adult life dedicated to working and helping troubled teens find recovery and safety. And after working for about 8 years in group homes, he spent the next 10 years as a very specialized therapist in working with adolescents that engaged in abusive and high-risk sexual behaviors. And that's where I first met Jared. So he's got about 18 years of experience with many opportunities in his background. He's also presented all across the country as an expert in the field. He's a nationally recognized expert. And then he became interested in polygraph. And he's going to share with us today about his interest in that, his training, what he does, how he has used it in the therapeutic process, how beneficial that could be. We were just talking before the show. I just thought, wow, that could really cut some time off of somebody having to be in residential treatment and kind of getting through some of those aspects of what they're struggling with or withholding information. So, Jared, welcome, and thank you for being here.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for the invite. It's very exciting.
Yep. I know you have lots of stories to share about how polygraph has worked as well. We also have some questions from listeners, which I think are great questions. I do think to start off, as you and I talked about, is that the perception is that polygraph is like what we all see on TV. It's used for that person who has, you know, murdered somebody or is trying to get away with some high intense criminal activity, but actually polygraph can be used in many beneficial ways for both adolescents, young adults, and adults.
Exactly. Yeah. No. So, I mean, if I could just touch on that point,
yes.
Ultimately, most of the clients I work with are not coming from an attorney or a police investigation, although I do those kind of tests as well, and they're kind of fun in their own right. The vast majority of tests that I do come from therapeutic communities. There's a very specialized group that I specialized in as a therapist, which is I specialize in kids who offend on other kids.
Yes.
So that world has always used, I mean, always, it's used polygraphs for many, many decades at this point, the adult and the youth world. And so sometimes it's coming from that therapeutic setting. And then the second very common group that I work with is infidelity. So like people that cheat on their spouses and things like that. And they're in therapy and they're trying to work through that relational trauma. And sometimes the polygraph is used as kind of a tool to kind of establish a baseline and help people move forward. So anyways, so yeah, a lot of my clients are coming from these other areas.
You know, I know that you've had some interesting experiences, or you know, around polygraph. But I also want people to know about some of the conferences that you've attended and presented at, you know, as an expert in the field.
Sure. Yeah. So when it comes to conferences, obviously there's lots of conferences throughout the United States is where I've mostly presented. But I've been at NATSAP several times in different states. The IACA is a conference that I've presented at several times. The American Polygraph Association, the APA, is the same as the American Psychological Association.
Oh, okay.
So the APA Psychological Association, I did a presentation on some techniques for trauma, like that, at a spirituality conference specifically for APA. And that ranged everywhere from California to Maine. So I've been across the entire United States doing some of that stuff.
Well, I spoke to somebody just this last week who was in the area visiting, and he had mentioned that he had seen your presentation at NATSAP at one time, and he was just fascinated, you know, again, at learning how it can be used. And so I know he's going to be listening to the show to learn even more. So I thought we could start off with some of the questions that were submitted. And then, of course, you know, please add to actual experiences of things that have happened that you can show in relation to how this has become a benefit. Alex in California says, can someone under the age of 18 take a polygraph?
So the answer is yes. In fact, I just finished completing a lit review for all the research done on children and adolescents in particular, but anything that was under 18, I completed a lit review that should be published coming here.
So, okay, great.
And there's not a ton of research on polygraph in adolescents, but everything that's ever been done shows that it's very effective. One of the things that we do know is polygraph is great at helping to aid in gaining information. Information gaining.
I would imagine
in the research. So its utility in terms of treatment is like, basically, if it's helpful to have more information and accurate information in a treatment process, then it's helpful to include the polygraph process.
Now, if an adolescent, let's say they're in a residential treatment setting and, you know, therapeutically, it's been recommended that, you know, polygraph be a part of their process. Does a parent have to give their permission when the child's under the age of 18?
That's correct. Yeah. Just like any sort of treatment, right? So I will collect their own signature, but they're not legally able to consent
right.
to that.
It just kind of lets them know. Yeah. Okay.
Yep. So that's that. All the rules would apply the same way to polygraph. But okay. Including the confidentiality components, right? You can't just go out and talk about that with anybody, and you can't disclose specific situations or specific names or whatever outside of the polygraph suite. So,
okay. Angie in Idaho says, is a polygraph admissible in court?
Because
on TV we see sometimes, oh yes, it's admissible. No, it's not admissible.
Yeah. Well, I will tell you probably the number one question I get is, well, more it's a challenge. People say, well, it's clearly not accurate because it's not allowed in court. And so we'll talk about the court dynamics. Okay. So there's a couple things with that. The general statement is true. It's not allowed in courts. There's a couple of exceptions to that. There's some states that allow it, but they're very few and far between.
Okay.
New Mexico, Alaska, and Connecticut. If I
were they able to say, here are the results of the polygraph.
Okay. It's just part of the process.
Okay.
And then in almost all states, they're allowed under what's called a stipulated exam. So that's if your defense attorney and your prosecutor agree to it before the test is done. Then
okay.
they take the test and those results are given.
Okay.
So those are allowed, but rarely done. But the reason for not including is if you watch YouTube videos, they're always going to tell you they're not accurate. That's why they're not included in court. That is not actually the legal argument for excluding polygraph. Polygraphs are quite accurate in terms of some just basic numbers on what's called a diagnostic exam. That's where there's a specific allegation. You're looking at low 90s, upper 80s in most studies. So anything from 87 to 95% accuracy on screening exams, which are mostly what I'll be talking about today. These are more like a test where you don't know the answer. There's no specific accusation. We're just trying to clarify. And those will sit in the mid 80s. So you're looking, again, there's always a range, but from the low 80s to the upper 80s. But right about 85% is a pretty good accuracy rate for a screening exam. Did I answer the question? Oh, courts. So the reason it's not allowed in courts, which is more accurate than like fingerprinting or ballistics or some of the other things that are used in court.
DNA.
So the actual legal argument against polygraph is that it's the prejudicial to the jury is the formal argument.
Oh.
What that means is in the United States, we believe that there's one group of people that get to make decisions about if someone's innocent or guilty.
And that's the jury. Right. The judge or the jury.
Even a judge is just sitting there to make sure the rules are being played fairly, right? The jury gets to make that decision. So you can introduce all sorts of evidence that says, hey, this looks suspicious. This fingerprint was here, and this bullet came out of this shell that was in their garage in the same set of, you know, ballistic stuff. But in a polygraph, we directly say, you did it.
Right. They were right or they were wrong. Yep.
You didn't do it and you're innocent. And because of that, we're not allowed. So well, even if it was 100% accuracy, we still weren't.
Okay. Annie in California says, can an innocent person fail a polygraph?
Yeah, so it would have to be 100% accurate for me to say, no, that's impossible. They're always correct. I would love to say that. That would be kind of exciting. But the answer is no. Again, if you're going off the screening exams, I'll use those because those are the ones that you do the most. Screening exams have an 85% accuracy rate. Okay. So we have a 15% known error. There's two types of errors. There's what are called false positives, which is what they're describing. Somebody comes in, they're honest, and I call them a liar. The statistics come out that they're a liar. Or the other one is they come in and they lie and I can't see it. That's called a false negative. And both of those are possible. In fact, there's no perfect test. Even DNA testing, right, which is among the best tests we have, isn't perfect. So yes, it does have an error rate. If I could know who was who, I would never make an error, but I will be wrong sometimes. So when you're doing polygraph, it's best to think of it as added information, right? Like you're taking this to the therapeutic.
Another tool in the process.
Another tool in the process. It's not a sole determinant by any means.
Okay. Bernie in Colorado says, can employers require employees to take polygraphs?
Quick answer is no. There's what's called the EPA, the Employee Protection, Employee Polygraph Protection Act.
Okay.
I can't remember what year it was passed, but it was many years ago in some controversial times. They said, look, we're not going to use this for employment anymore. There was lots of employers using it historically. We're talking 70s.
Like pre-employment or when something happened?
So both. They'd use it for usually theft screening. So just every 6 months or every year, they pull in all their executives or their low-level employees and just say, have you stolen anything from the
country? Embezzling money. That happened like if you worked for a bank or something.
Yeah. So banks were high consumers of that. Ironically, convenience stores like 7-Elevens and stuff like that.
Oh, really?
Shoe stores were among the highest consumers of the pre-employment polygraphs polygraphs. But currently the only one that's allowed to do polygraphs as far as employment is if you're becoming a police officer, a correction officer, if you're working for the FBI, Homeland Security. Sometimes we heard a lot about it in the news with the border security.
Yeah.
There was a time where they were trying to really up the number of players in the game and they get polygraphed and the polygraph was kind of, there wasn't enough people doing the exams. And so it took a long time to get them through. And that was an issue a couple of years ago.
Anyway. Okay. Caitlin in California says, will Xanax help you pass a polygraph?
Yeah. So let's talk countermeasures in general. So
what if somebody's taking a medication for anxiety or depression or bipolar or...
So medications, when we take a polygraph, we're always doing a differential response rate of their own physiology to questions that are being asked. So the basic concepts, you're comparing what you know is true to what you know is a lie to something that you're trying to figure out. And it's the differential response rate between those different types of questions. So what that means is when you're on medications, you've got a homeostasis, a set body point, and we're looking at variations on that body point. So your Xanax is not necessarily going to like allow you. You certainly can't pass or fail based on
because any of a medication. Okay.
That includes illicit drugs. That includes alcohol. Now, especially with the really intense benzos that are used PRN style, if you're really doped up and not really in a good mental space,
would you then administer the polygraph at that point?
Oh, absolutely. I would assume that would be pretty obvious and just not do the test. But even if you did the test, they're likely to get what's called an inconclusive. That's we have people that pass, people that fail, and then if there's a statistical no man's zone where we don't make a decision. So that would be the risk. If you're on high doses of Xanax or benzos or alcohol or huge doses of marijuana, that could kind of level things out to the point where it's hard to, but it wouldn't help you pass and it wouldn't fail you.
Okay. Dina in Utah says, so what legislation applies to polygraph? Do you need to be licensed? And does every state have different laws? So it's kind of a three-part question. So what legislation applies to polygraph?
So the only legislation that's kind of directly applicable is the EPA one that we already mentioned, that you can't test for employment. So for example, if I'm running like a group home, I couldn't test my staff.
Okay.
That would be schools. And then other legislation would be just about admissibility in court. So that's the legislation I'm aware of.
Okay. And do you need to be licensed as somebody who gives polygraphs? I would imagine. So let's talk a little bit about the licensing and the training and what you had to go through in order to start this.
So licensing throughout the United States is super disparate. So there's lots of states that don't require a license.
Oh, wow. Really?
There's many that have very strict standards. So Utah happens to be a very strict standard licensing state. So the basics, when you do to become a polygraph examiner, it's more like a trade versus like a master's degree. So my background, I'm a therapist, as was previously mentioned. This is not a master's degree. I went to 10 weeks of basic training, and then I did an additional specialty training so I could work with some of the sex specific issues.
Okay.
And so after those two trainings, you're good to go in states that don't require a license. In Utah, there's an additional requirement of at least 1 year of internship and 200 exams. So whichever one comes later. So you have to do, if it takes
more than
10 exams, right, then you can become fully licensed and operate on your own.
Okay.
There was actually an article in a recent Polygraph magazine that addressed the licensing standards in different states. And I was shocked how different they are and how we're fairly strict. And I was a little bit horrified at how many states did not have licensing requirements.
Somebody could just open up their doors and say, I'm going to give polygraph exam.
Hang a plaque and say, let's do this. You know, I think that would be fairly dangerous. I think my clinical background allows for both understanding.
I would think so. Yeah.
Right. How to do the interview without having it be overly like
aggressive.
Yeah. That kind of almost like interrogation style stuff.
Right.
A lot of people that do polygraphs, their background tends to be in law enforcement or FBI or CIA, Homeland Security, that sort of thing. And so I think there's a little mentality there that can lend itself that direction, but it's certainly not universally true. And most people that are doing polygraphs are quite expert at doing good clinical interviews. But if I used to do assessments, and it feels a lot like doing an assessment. I have really cool toys I can play with at the end. That's the main
So, I mean, what equipment is involved in giving polygraphs?
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know if I could show you. Can I show you with my camera? I don't know if this will be too annoying. So here's what people think of. This is the old school. I can't.
Okay.
See. Maybe you can't see.
Hooked up.
Oh, right there. Right there. So that's what people think of when they see a polygraph, right?
Okay.
Little squiggly lines and a piece of paper that's shooting out.
Yeah.
They haven't used those since like the early 90s.
It's just a
little box that sits on your computer. It's all computerized.
Oh, really?
The rest of the world. So we measure five things, but only four of them deal with whether someone's telling the truth or lying, deception. In order of accuracy, we measure what's called the electrodermal activity. That's the electrical current in your body as you sweat. So basically, there's two ways of measuring that. They'll take little pads, like metal plates that go on your fingers, or sometimes we put stickers on the palm of your hand.
Right.
That's the most accurate of anything that we measure. Okay. Then there's what's called a PLE. It's looking for vasomotor constriction, which is how thick your blood vessels are, it goes through your veins. Then there's a good old cardio cuff that lots of people think of when they see polygraph. It's just
blood pressure.
Yep, it's not necessarily, we're looking at blood volume change, but it's the same toy.
Okay.
The same thing, blood pressure. So I don't have to pump it up quite quite as tight as a dock, but anyways, okay. So that's the third most accurate. And the least accurate are the two tubes that are also kind of iconic.
Oh, go across the chest.
They go across your chest and your belly. And they're looking for respiration. So those are the four things we measure.
Okay.
And respiration is the least accurate. EDA is the most accurate. And the computer algorithm, when it calculates the output, weights them according to how accurate they are. So your EDA is going to get a lot more weight than like the pneumos that have less accuracy. So that's the numeric piece. And then the fifth thing we measure is just movements. So there's different people have different toys for this, but I have a specific chair that's got like a butt pad and arm pads, and you put your feet on a second set of pads, third set of pads, however you want to think about that. And we're looking at movements. Movements are just to look for any like deviation from norm. So okay. if you cough, or if you shuffle in your chair, if you start tapping your toes or something like that, it can create reactions not related to questions. So those get zeroed out and they're excluded.
Okay. Okay. Do you have to keep a face that doesn't show any emotion as you're doing this? Are they looking at you for positive?
So they look at the wall. So eye to eye contact is, I mean, especially as therapists, we know like that is as rewarding as just about anything. It stimulates lots of like action in the brain. So I don't want them looking in my eyes.
Okay.
So I have them sitting kind of looking at a wall. That's kind of a blank. And it's real slow, and they hear the questions over and over again. So anyways,
And I think we answered the third part, you know, does every state have different laws? Evidently that's true.
Incredibly so, yeah.
Glenn in Utah says, how many questions can be asked during a polygraph, and how long does it last?
Sure. So it lasts way longer than people expect. On television and movies, where we get most of our information.
It's like a minute.
It's like 30 seconds to maybe a couple minutes. The real process takes several hours. I schedule a 3-hour gap for each of my questions. So it doesn't always take 3 hours. I'd say 2 hours, give or take 30 minutes, is very, very common. But I do certainly have some that go the full 3 hours and occasionally over that. So it takes a long time.
Okay.
And in the process, you're going to do a big, long interview. And that's without being hooked up to all the equipment I just described.
That's prior to.
During the interview, you're just trying to establish some baselines, get some background information, make sure you understand what's happening. And then you put together specific questions for the actual test. Those are reviewed with the client before the test, so they know exactly what's going to be asked. And so there's no tricks or surprises during a polygraph. And then the test itself is real slow and repetitive, so you hear the same questions over and over again. That's another thing you'll see in like YouTube videos. You'll see these like famous people get hooked up to usually one of these old school polygraphs, and they'll pepper them with questions, and they'll be like, oh, you lied to that one. And it's like immediate feedback. It actually doesn't really work like
that. Okay.
That's called the peak of attention test. And so that you can do that, but the accuracy is really bad. I mean, you're talking just barely above chance, 60s, mid 60s.
Oh, yeah. That doesn't sound very accurate then.
Yeah. So you would never do anything in real life like that. That's purely for show and whatever. So anyways, you'll repeat those questions over and over again so that we can look at statistics, the statistical comparison over time. And that's where our accuracy comes from.
Okay. Greg in Alabama says, can you fail a polygraph by being nervous? I'm sure everybody must be nervous.
Yeah. The quick answer is no, for the same reason as the drugs, actually. So we set it to your own baseline. So your anxiety, even a full-blown anxiety disorder, you can do just fine on a polygraph.
Okay.
And be nervous. So that's, I think that's even expected. If somebody comes in completely
calm,
there's probably some psychopathy, or maybe
they're trying to fool it. Okay. I'm going to be watching these programs now with a whole different mindset. Jennifer in Utah says, can mental or physical disabilities cause you to fail a polygraph test? And what about someone who is ASD? I think that's a great question.
Yeah. Those are lots of different pieces, right? So general concepts will be the same as I've described. You're dealing with their own physiology. So the disability shouldn't affect things. ASD shouldn't affect things. Okay. We do have an error rate. So maybe some of that's related to some of those things. And we just don't know that that's what's causing it. So there's always those caveats, right? There's the unknown when it doesn't work. But there's no specific group that you couldn't test, except that people with lower cognitive ability, thinking well below average. So if your average IQ,
what would be too low for you to want to test?
So anything that's below like 80,
okay,
IQ levels, if you're looking at just an IQ test, I think you want to start being careful about that.
Okay.
I do have to work with people that are required to do tests regardless of whatever. And so when I do those tests, I add a little disclaimer. I say, look, we know that the accuracy goes down with cognitive delays. So the other piece is psychotic, like active psychosis. Mm-hmm. If they're treated stable psychosis, that's fine, right? Like they're just like normal people. But if you're in an active delusion,
like schizophrenic type of situation,
your schizophrenic types, or like a lot of like depression and anxiety can have those side features in extreme cases of delusional stuff. You can test a delusion of somebody that really believes it, and it will look like it's true, not because it is, but because it's they believe it. And I don't test what really happened. I don't test like big T truth. I test little T truth. So I'm testing what they perceive to be the truth, what they perceive to be accurate.
So somebody with high functioning ASD, Asperger's, autism would be able to accomplish a polygraph test.
They'd be a great candidate.
Okay.
The warning to the polygraph examiner that's doing the test is just to be really clear about that review of the questions phase. I will read the question and say, what do you think that means? And then I'll pull out specific words. What does this word mean? And then make sure we're just right on the same page, because you don't want it to be interpreted differently than what you
right mean. Okay. That's actually very good to know. Jonathan in Colorado says, how accurate is a polygraph? I think you've kind of talked about that. You know, nothing's going to be 100%, but that there is high accuracy.
But well above chance, yeah. I mean, let me give you one comparison point.
Okay.
Clinical judgment, right? So me as a therapist, just sitting down with my client, do I believe this person? 54% accurate.
Oh, wow.
That's actually remains true for all sorts of populations. Police officers that are formally trained and trying to find deception, 54% accuracy.
Wow.
Spouses with one another, 54% accuracy. Total strangers, 54%. It all sits at, they call it the golden mean. They keep coming to that same number over and over again.
Wow.
So when you're increasing the accuracy to the mid 80s, even though that is far from perfect, it is way better than just we can do on our own.
Okay. Krista in Utah says, how does someone hire a polygraph examiner? So let's talk about a private person hiring you versus, say, a residential treatment center hiring you or a therapist hiring you.
Yeah, and some of that will vary a little bit. So the quick resource would be the American Polygraph Association has a website under polygraph.org.
Okay.
And they'll have a list of examiners in all states. So that's a great resource. There's another one, the National Polygraph Association, NPA. And I can't remember their website, but if you Googled it, you'd find it. And they have a list of all polygraph examiners that are members of their
okay
organization. That would be a good way to find a polygraph examiner.
Okay.
In terms of hiring, like, so for example, I don't do private exams. So if you called me up and said, hey, I'm having trouble with my kid, I just want to do this test, I would refer you to somebody else.
Who does?
And there's other,
okay.
And there are other guys that will do just private exams.
Okay.
I will only work with you if you're in therapy and,
okay,
or if you're, you know, obviously residential is therapy.
Right. So
what I want is that the information is going to be processed in session. Information alone is not always healing. Information in a therapeutic context can be very healing. And so I don't want to do these outside of that context. That I will say is pretty unique to me personally. I think.
Really?
I don't know anybody else that does that. That's just, it could be my therapy background, right? Like it could be just, I come at this thing thinking about the way that healing happens. You know, I think about somebody that cheated on their spouse, right? Just worst case scenario here. Let's say somebody come in, they failed their test. They've cheated beyond.
Now they're angry.
Now they're angry. Their partner finds out and then shoots them or something, right?
Right. Like, I mean, they're processing what's happening.
We know that relationship trauma is one of the big triggers for violence. And I'm not going to send somebody home when it's an unstable situation. I can't make sure it's safe. So yeah. I send it to a therapist.
Okay.
A therapist will process that with them.
Okay. So,
that's personal choice. I would love to see that as a more of a
standard. I mean, that just seems appropriate, you know, from my standpoint too, and maybe because I come from a clinical background as well. But like you said, I'd be wary of a parent bringing their kid in. I want to know if they're using drugs, or I want to know if they're stealing, and then they find out and they're not in therapy or having some kind of support system. Now you've just unbottled an angry situation that could become
They go home, dad reads the report, he's like, what the heck, you've been lying to me, and beats the crap out of the kid, and now I've created harm,
right?
Yeah. So I've violated the very minimal
essence of what it is you're wanting to do. Yeah, that's great. I'm glad to hear that. Lori in Colorado says, how many questions are usually asked in a polygraph test? I think that is going to kind of vary, and, you know, goes along with how much time you're spending too.
Well, it's actually more contained than that. I can give you a pretty close answer to
okay.
that. So it's surprisingly few. When we do a test, you're always doing a comparative analysis. I think I mentioned that before, where you test, there's some questions and some questions you tell them to lie to and some target questions.
So you can figure
things. So all the questions, the ones they're talking about though, is the target questions. How many things can I ask in a polygraph and learn about that I can get statistical information on? And you're talking anywhere from 2 to maybe 4. There's one test that does 4 questions in the same go. Personally, I've never tested a 4-question test. The more questions you do in a single test, the less accurate that test is. So I use 2 and 3-question tests regularly. If I'm going to go up to 4 questions, I would do 2 2-question tests in the same test go.
And so are you asking the same question over and over, or are you asking it in different ways, but it's the same question?
Verbatim. So when they get repeated, it's verbatim.
Oh,
when I say two different tests, I mean literally like that. That's like 2 different questions with two tests with 2 questions each would get me to 4 questions.
Okay.
But that's about the limits. You can get up to 6. I've done that in a single episode, but that's really the upper limits. But you'd want to do that in pieces. You wouldn't want there's no format that can do 6 questions at the same time accurately.
Okay. Wow, so that's a long time to be asking those same questions over and over.
Oh, yeah. That's really like 30 minutes. Think 30 minutes for that last part of those questions. Most of the time, that the 2 to 3 hours is the interview. The interview takes
for
that time.
Okay.
So once you get the clarity, then you move into the questions and the
process. And they know it's coming because you've discussed it ahead of time.
And it psychologically prepares them to do well. So the interview is mostly for innocent people. Like if you just came in, sat them down, hooked them up, ran a test, the liars would just show easily. But the person that's trying to be honest and is maybe a little unsure about what to say, and they've never really talked about some of this stuff, they got some secrets, but maybe it's not exactly what you're trying to ask them. Those guys might fail just because they didn't have a chance to clarify and talk. So I want them talking, and that helps. So the interview is for an innocent person. The guy that's going to fail is probably going to fail anyway. So we're done.
So Rodney in Arizona says, you know, how much does the polygraph test cost?
It's kind of like the standards for different states, right? You're going to roll anywhere from, on the low end, you're probably looking at maybe $150, $200. On the high end, it can be upwards of $1,000. That really depends on state. You know, and kind of context, like mine costs different depending on what's going
on. Depending on what you're doing.
When they're in treatment, they're already paying for treatment and it's just an adjunct to that. So those are cheaper. If they're a client, like an attorney client where it's a criminal case and it's going to be evaluated at a higher end and I have to be really meticulous in my documentation and there's lots of review of documents, I charge a lot more for that. But that's a typical range, anywhere from you know, a couple hundred dollars to $1,000.
Okay.
And in the middle there is probably more average.
Sebastian in Colorado says, how many different uses are there for a polygraph test? I know we've talked about a couple of them. So you're doing tests for those in residential treatment. And are you just doing residential treatment for those particular students who've sexually offended? Are you doing other residential treatment?
Right. So that's a great question. So the milieu maintenance is what I would call that type of a polygraph. That's where I'm just making sure that things are safe in the group home.
Okay.
That everybody's doing well. And the vast majority of polygraph is done by the group that works with kids that offend on other kids.
Okay.
The reason for that is I think it's just more like there's this program that we have that it's for criminals, and we look at that group as being criminal. And so somehow it's okay to use with them, but not with other people. So the vast majority of testing I do with adolescents in group homes is for group homes that specialize in that area. Now, can I interject a story here?
Yes, absolutely.
This following story is probably the most scary moment, most disconcerting, I don't know exactly what word to use, of my professional career. When I was the clinical director of a group home that used polygraphs, we had three different facilities. We had a private facility where polygraphs were used both in trying to establish histories for kids. That's a test where we're working with kids who have offended on other kids. People are very secretive about that behavior. So they may get caught for something, but that doesn't mean that that's the end of the story. And
right.
They're very going to just tell us the story. So the polygraph allowed us to help the honesty up front and saved us lots of time and treatment because we could just get to the truth and move on. For the individual client, lots of times their ability to like feel they've been, put everything on the table and they're still okay. Brene Brown has this great concept where she talks about until you're fully known and loved anyways, you can't truly like feel loved.
Right.
And I think for some people, there's this powerful piece that comes from being honest about really scary topics. So anyways, here's the story. We had three facilities. We had the private facility. We had a DCFS facility. So DCFS kids were kids that had, they've all committed sex crimes. So these ones had been pulled from their homes originally because of the neglect and abuse of their parents. They ended up engaging in some illegal activities, ended up in the group home. And then we had JJS kids. And JJS kids are the kids that were criminally prosecuted for their own offenses.
Okay.
So those are the three facilities. At one of our facilities, our JJS facility, the JJS just decided not to pay for polygraphs. And so because they didn't pay for polygraphs, that one group was treated without. We've been working for years and years with JJS. And one day we get a phone call and the phone call says, hey, we need to come in and review your files. And we said, fine, what's the issue? And they say, well, there's a situation where a staff appears to have been sexual with one of the boys.
No. And these are adolescents?
These are adolescent boys. Oh. And so our staff was a female residential director at the time. She was like the boss of the staff.
Okay.
And so we're like, yeah, totally fine. Come in and see our files. And they're like, oh, and by the way, it's going to be on the news tonight.
Oh my gosh.
And we're going to put a moratorium on any new placements from Utah on your JGS facility. So until this is resolved, we're no longer going to place kids with you. Totally fine. That's great. Come in, do your investigation. Okay. Here's all our files. Let's have a conversation. Like, we didn't know about this. We didn't do anything wrong. She did something wrong and let's criminally prosecute her. Totally fine.
Right.
So when they came in to review our files, like they almost treat us like we had
done something wrong,
knew about it or something, right? Like if I had known about this, she would have been fired that day, right? Like we would have reported her to the police and let them do their thing, and the end result, she did go to jail, and that's what should have happened. So that's great. But the end result of this whole thing is they shut down our JJS facility, and in one instant, a bad decision from one of my staff took away the ability to help all sorts of kids, and a whole group home was shut down because of it.
Wow. And for kids who really needed it, probably so much more than others. Yeah.
And this is the pinnacle moment for me when it comes to polygraph. I would have known about that situation if I could have been testing.
Had you been testing, yeah.
And in my ignorance, I was unable to address an issue. And then it looks like we did something wrong, which we did not. And this is an issue that I think is an important message for individuals that are in dealing with treatment, especially in these situations where on the most facilities are doing a fabulous job and most treatment goes beautifully. And sometimes there's a bad apple, and those bad apples have seriously souring effects and can shut down your entire facility.
Well, and they affect the other kids that are there. It starts, I mean, I've seen it happen. We all know that it's happened. You know, it starts filtering in through the other kids. It can become an underground situation. The staff then know something's going on, but aren't sure what's going on. It just, you know, everything starts becoming a little bit unbalanced. Right. And without any answers, then it's difficult to know exactly what's taking place. You kind of might know the person who is creating this, but you just don't have enough information. And obviously everybody's lying. So you just don't have enough information to really bring back the balance to what's taking place.
Right.
Yeah, I've seen it happen.
That's where I think that many facilities in particular are missing an opportunity to create safety in their programs. And it's a place that polygraph isn't being used, like almost at all. I have one client that's not specific to sex.
So you're talking about the what I'll call the more traditional residential treatment centers for kids with anxiety, depression, maybe right. some alcohol, drug abuse, behaviors. Right. You know, other reasons that they're in residential treatment or therapeutic right. treatment.
Right. And what a great opportunity you have to check in. Like they go on a home pass and everything seems to be doing fine. But did they tap into their friend's vape? Do they have any drugs that are hidden around the house? Have they contacted people that they shouldn't mm-hmm. be? Have they been using pornography on their home devices when that's against their safety plans? Right. Like we can know this information. We don't have to guess and cross our fingers and hope. And polygraph can be very informative. And that way, when people go home, you have greater confidence that things are safe. It also provides in the worst case scenarios of the sour apples of your staff. You can't test your staff, right, EPA? You can't test your staff.
Right, right.
But you can't test the kids, and the kids know.
Right,
and
so right.
If there's staff that are up to no good, you're going to know. If there's
the kids are going to tell you, yeah.
You're going to learn that, right?
Yeah. Wow. Sean in Chicago says, can someone truly beat a polygraph test?
Yes. The quick answer is yes.
You know, I did watch a couple of YouTube videos about that because I was like, I think there are some people who, I'm going to beat this. I'm going to read right. all the information. I think that I actually came across a book, How to Beat a Polygraph Test.
That's probably Matchkey. He wrote that.
Yes.
So here's the quick go. Let me cite a study.
Okay.
So this is a study by a guy named Charles Hantz. He's up at Boise State University. He does a lot of polygraph research. He did probably one of the coolest researches on countermeasures and cheating.
Okay.
Had a couple of phases to it. So it's a little complex. I'll try to make it as quick as possible. So he basically takes a group of people. Among that group, they're going to be divided into six groups. Three are going to be assigned to try to cheat with no information.
Okay.
One group is going to be assigned to cheat. They're supposed to cheat without any information. And that includes people that were actually lying and people that weren't. They do these like mock crimes. So they create a scenario and then they go through the crime, and some people don't do the crime and some people do. And then you polygraph them and the polygrapher doesn't know who's who. So that's okay. A typical polygraph design. So that's the polygraph design. So then you break them into these three groups. So I have a group that's told you need to cheat. Do whatever you can to try to cheat with no information.
Okay.
A second group is given all the material you just mentioned, YouTube videos and that specific book, probably the Matchkey book, to read about it and to study. And they say, go home, study this for a week, come back, we'll take a polygraph. And pass your polygraph. You get extra money if they actually pass the polygraph.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And then that third group was actually trained for a week, hooked up to a polygraph, learning about polygraph theory, watching their physiology, and learning the biometric process, right? Yeah. So the group, something that you'll read online is that it's impossible to pass a polygraph unless you help yourself cheat. And so even innocent people may believe they have to cheat to do well. And so that's why he used like even innocent groups to cheat. So anyways, the group that just tried something, just do anything that comes to mind, completely unsuccessful, didn't work at all.
Okay.
The people that read the books and watched the YouTube videos and primed themselves and got good information that could be helpful, didn't help them at all.
Okay.
The only group that had any success whatsoever was the group that was hooked up to a polygraph and the biometrics were being...
And they had a lot of information. Yeah.
Yeah, they have a lot of information. And what they were successful at was not failing. They were actually not successful at passing. So they got that okay. inconclusive range I mentioned. So the best they could do is to increase their capacity to not fail. So theoretically, is it possible? Yes. Is it probable?
No.
No.
Okay.
Even if they go online and search and try to figure things out, Godspeed, go ahead. It's not going to work.
Well, I want to make sure that people know how to reach you. You know, the site or these programs are listed on the site Horizon Family Solution, and there are, you know, both adolescent and young adult programs and treatment centers and therapists and psychologists on that site. So hopefully they'll get a chance to see this. But how would they reach out to you, Jared, to get more information and to, you know, to speak with you about the possibility of using your services?
Sure. So specifically for me, I have a website, intermountainpolygraph.com. So that's a great place, intermountainpolygraph.com.
And you're in Utah.
Yeah, I'm in Utah. And so that would give you like my phone number and my...
Okay. And I'll make sure that that's on your page as well on the site.
All that stuff. And so you can certainly reach out that way. Again, lots of people aren't going to be in Utah, and there are other examiners in Utah. And so the polygraph.org website is a great resource for looking for polygraph examiners in general.
Okay.
So yeah, those are two great resources.
Okay. What's the one thing you'd like to leave with everybody that makes them feel positive about what you're doing?
Sure. Well, I would say this. I think truth matters, and I think that truth is healing, and I think that the opportunities we have to put our souls out there and all the dark skeletons and to be accepted, it's the Brené Brown stuff, to be accepted is the way I come to self-acceptance, because I can at that point know that I'm okay despite whatever's happened. And there is few things in life that's that powerful. And if this is an aid for creating healing for an individual in treatment, then I think it's a fabulous aid.
It could just cut through so much wasted time in being able to get to the truth. So you can then actually work on that.
Exactly. And it's not a replacement to treatment. It's not
great. Right. No, it's an addition to. Yeah.
It's an addition to. And that can be a powerful tool. And for facilities, if you're thinking about formal facilities, I think it would be a great boon to the safety in the facility. Because
And I think for young adults as well that are doing their work also, because they've spent even more years being secretive and in denial and not sharing, and now here they are into their adulthood, and it's, you know, it has manifested even more problems for them.
Right. And if you have a pattern of not being believed,
yes,
you pass a polygraph, it is incredibly relieving.
Very powerful.
They can walk away and say, look, I have scientific evidence that what I said is true, you know, that can be helpful. The other thing to know is people believe what they want to believe. So sometimes a parent may be stuck anyways, or a family member may be stuck anyways and just assume that they're lying and they cheated on the polygraph or whatever. But for them individually, it can be very
powerful. It can be very powerful. Yeah. I know that we've got you scheduled to come back, I think, two more times over the coming months. You just have so much information to share on other topics as well. And I'm looking forward to having you back and really picking your brain for some more things. It's so great to see you and to see what you're doing. And I'm going to keep your information as well. I may be reaching out to you also. So thanks for being here today, Jared. I want to let everyone know that our guest next week is actually an author and a speaker and an advocate who's written a book that says, Don't Expect Me to Cry. Her name is Janet Bentley, and she is going to talk about self-compassion as a trauma recovery tool. If you get a chance to get her book, Don't Expect Me to Cry, it's very heartwarming to read, and it's a little dark at times, but just what an advocate she's become through her story. I want to leave you all today with my saying is begin grateful. Waiting, and there's sure a lot happening in our world, but there's always something to be grateful for. I hope you can reach out and find it and really appreciate the lives that we have. Take care, everyone. I will be back next Thursday, 11 a.m. Pacific, 12 noon Mountain. Dori Francis with Every Voice Matters. And yes, every voice matters. Thank you for being here. Take care.
You're listening to Every Voice Matters with Dori Francis, only on LA Talk Radio.